All right. It's 10:33. This might, we'll see how this goes. So, you know, when you say your topic is God, and you give yourself like 20 minutes. First, by way of introduction, I mentioned last month that I wanted to dedicate a series of talks on what I consider to be essential questions of any religious community, at least in the West, that's coming out of some Western context. And to address those essential questions with a retrospective view and perhaps an anticipatory view as well, where my own thinking has been and where religious communities might be headed. So I do need to qualify that this talk today and subsequent talks are my views. Traditionally, throughout most of my ministry, I have tried to withhold my own views, although that's of course impossible, but my primary interest has been to spark thoughts in the hearer to encourage people to develop their own views of religious ideas, religious thoughts, spiritual questions. These are a little more explicitly my own thoughts. So that's a caveat that you ought to keep in mind. And if my views challenge dear and dearly held ideas that you might hold, I don't mean to be disturbing, I don't mean to offer offense, but rather these are ideas for us to consider. Also, you should know that many of the ideas I'm going to share today and throughout the series have been considered heretical at one time or another in the history of Western religions. So you have a heretic before you. I want to begin with a story with my son Nick. When Nick was a little boy, he's probably around five, I think, when this happened. I was a pastor at the time of a church, a very large church, Protestant church. And Nick and I were driving, and as we passed a Catholic church, it was a small, but it had kind of unusual architecture, so it drew his attention. It didn't look quite like a church. But as we were driving by, a wedding was recessing from the church, so the priest was standing in front of the church with full regalia, and people were milling about, and Nick turned and said, "Daddy, what is that building?" He was looking at the architecture and then all these people, and I said, "Well, that's a church." He said, "Well, who is that man in front of the church?" Because again, it had this full regalia on. And I said, "Well, that's the priest. He serves that church. He's like a minister." And then he said, "Well, does he live there?" I said, "You mean in that building?" "Yeah, does he live there?" And I said, no, he doesn't live there. And then Nick said, "Well, who does live there?" You know, and I just answered back what first came to my mind. He said, "Well, I suppose God lives there." And Nick laughed and looked at me and said, "Ah, Dad, God's a pretend guy." If you didn't catch it, I was the minister of a very large Protestant church at that time. Ah, Nick, my little budding philosopher. He could have been channeling any number of thinkers that have defined the modern era. And in fact, he did grow up to study philosophy and was a very fine philosopher before he headed off to other things. He could have been a little Durkheim, arguing that God is an invention of human communities and construction of society that projects its collective experience onto an external symbol. Or he could have been a little Sigmund Freud, that God is a projection of the internally conflicted ego Or perhaps God is a mythical phantasm that we refer to in everyday speech, although we know it doesn't really exist, something like unicorns or dragons. This little postmodern fellow could hardly have known how succinctly he was articulating the dominant modern and Western view of the divine, that we have invented the gods, that God is a human projection, either of our desire for power or our deep need for assurance. As the critic J. Hillis Miller once wrote, to discover that there never has been any celestial world can be a joyful liberation. And now man says of himself, this happy creature, it is he that invented the gods. It is he that put into their mouths the only words they have ever spoken. For the ancients, God was a reality, not a phantasm or an invention. That God was that that manifested itself in the powerful forces of nature and in the mind that clearly can see these powers. These powers exist beyond the control of humans. So all of the forces that we experience in life that are beyond our control must be under the control of some other being. There are forces and wonders, things that cannot be explained, but they are powers beyond the realm that we control. These are powers to be appeased, at best, through rituals and sacrifices. Throughout most of human existence, this kind of God, or the gods, was assumed, an assumed reality. It was not considered even as a topic of inquiry or debate. It just is so. Indeed, the ancients not only assumed the reality of God, they imagined a spiritual realm also filled with spirits and gods, usually related to some kind of overwhelming power observed in nature. Gods of lightning and thunder, for example, gods of mountains, or gods of the sea, gods associated with death, gods of fertility and birth. The Hindu pantheon, in fact, included 33 million gods. We won't start listing them today, but ancient Judaism itself and the Hebrew people actually included multiple deities. We forget that. English translations of the Hebrew Bible tend to collapse the many and diverse names of the Holy One into either God or Lord. Someone's phone, anyway. Is that who's calling? I couldn't resist that a little bit. Anyway. Where was I? Oh yeah, the Hebrews, English translations of the Hebrew Bible collapse all of these different deities into one of two names, either God, G-O-D, or the Lord, usually spelled all caps. But the ancient scriptures are replete with differing names for the deity, which suggests a pantheon of the gods. There's El, El Shaddai, El Olam, El Elyon, Yahweh, or Jehovah, the tetragrammaton that the Jews do not pronounce, but either use Adonai or the Holy One in its place, and Elohim, an important Hebrew word, which is itself a plural word, implying the gods are plural. As Judaism matured and through its history of empire, collapse, and recovery, Hebrew polytheism became a kind of, this is a term new to many of you, I'm sure, but a kind of henotheism. That is, henotheism simply means there are many gods, but there is one God above all the other gods. That God became Yahweh, translated into English as Lord. The preeminence of Yahweh eventually became an exclusive idea. There aren't many gods, there's only one God. The Almighty, the King of creation. There are variants on this theme, but the idea of a single deity, the God from whom all things exist and toward which all things seek to return, became the dominant idea throughout the Western and Middle Eastern worlds. For almost 3,000 years, this idea has held. Christianity and Islam both became the heirs of that Jewish insight, and Christianity is then melding with Greek thought and Roman society, further established this idea of God as progenitor, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, transcendent. But it's important also to note here that both Judaism and much later Islam prohibited any pictorial or physical representation of God, of the divine, of the Holy One. Judaism even prohibits the pronunciation of a name for God. So when I say Yahweh, that is the Tetragrammaton in the Hebrew Bible, that would not ever be said even in contemporary Reform Judaism. It would simply be Adonai, or the Holy One. Judaism prohibits the pronunciation of the name of God, lest we fall into confining God to our definitions and names. God is always beyond our conceptual capacity as human beings. Mosques, to this very day, similarly, direct their worship always toward an utterly empty space. The direction of Islamic worship in a mosque is to the Qibla, and the Qibla must always be empty. Even the word for God in Arabic is not present in the Qibla. It's an empty space reminding the believer and the worshiper that God is the no thing, beyond all things. It can't be represented. Idolatry, that is the worship of anything other than the true God, is always close at hand. The human temptation to confuse our conceptions and images of God with the reality of God is an ever-present caution in Islam and Judaism. Christianity did not fare quite as well. Quite early in its development and separation from Judaism, Christians adopted the Greek and Roman aesthetic of images for the divine. Very early, we see pictorial representations of God that promote the idea of God as a being, a super-duper being, but a being, like a human being. God then becomes an object to be studied, defined, an object outside of and above the world, but one that is objectified and therefore defined. God becomes in that way a projection of the human imagination. Rather than humans created in the image of God, God becomes created in the image of humans. So this form of Christian theism became dominant, and this idea colonized much of the world's religions. This construction of God, carried along by Christianity, was so dominant that the idea of God as a corporeal being became culturally assumed once again. Rarely challenged or critiqued, but it just became the way most of the West and the heirs of the West think of God. The medieval idea of God became that kind of assumed concept of the divine, a grand, grandfatherly being standing over and above the world from outside in heaven, creating, directing, intervening as a super being would. But those constructions began to break down with the dawn of the modern age. You know, there are libraries full of books describing the gathering questions that undermined the old idea of God. We could begin with the new cosmology of Copernicus, Kepler, Newton, Galileo. There's an essay by Margaret Wertheim that was passed along to me by Erica. It's a wonderful article titled Lost in Space, The Spiritual Crisis of Newtonian Cosmology. And Wertheim argues that the old religious ideas of God began to crumble with the realization that we are not the center of the universe, and that there is no spiritual realm beyond or above the world. Wertheim wrote, "This new cosmology had profound theological consequences, for with physical space extended to infinity, there was literally no room left for heaven or the deities that would live in such a heaven." The Enlightenment can be defined, in fact, by the extension of these new insights into the nature of the world and the universe to every human endeavor. You simply do not need the old ideas of God to explain phenomena in the world or the universe. And that includes human experience. The Baron von Holbach could write in the late 18th century as an Enlightenment figure that religions and theologians have simply created God as a, quote, gigantic, exaggerated man. That they aggrandized this being until it became inconceivable. By the end of the 19th century, the German philosopher Nietzsche would finally write the coup de grace. God is dead. He would write in the Gay Science, God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has now bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off of us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? It's a really interesting quote. Nietzsche dramatically articulated what he understood, that the ideas of the Enlightenment had unleashed a kind of force that killed the possibility of belief in God or any gods having ever existed in these personified ways. And less than 100 years later, the popular Time magazine ran a very famous cover in 1966 in a black cover with block red print, "Is God Dead?" Well, not quite. The old images linger, for one thing. Perhaps Michelangelo's famous depiction of God and Adam on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, you know, that grand gesture of creation, is partly to blame, but nevertheless, we still, many of us, refer to God conceptually as a supreme being. References to God in anthropomorphic terms still abound. If you listen carefully to God talk today, there's usually an underlying assumption that God is like us, only super duper. The functions of religion of churches here and abroad still speak of God as a supernatural being, a kind of Zeus, a superhero of immense proportions, occupying a supernatural place called heaven, intervening and directing the affairs in mysterious ways, but nevertheless there. I think many know that this is infantile. That's harsh. Yet the language used in reference to the divine persists with this kind of spiritual poverty, lacking a linguistic currency for meaningful concepts and speech. The controversial Bishop John Spong described the situation when he wrote, "Whether we like it or not, today's knowledge revolution and an emerging human maturity have conspired to make these theistic patterns of the past unbelievable." So, typical pious terms, for example, for God, reflect other problems of these anthropomorphic images of God. The word Lord, similar terms of nobility, King, King of creation, Heavenly Father, they all reflect medieval hierarchies and male androcentric images. We don't live with kings and lords or princes and knights. anymore. And the damage of exclusively masculine images of the divine renders so much of God talk as just as hollow habit. The inadequacy of the old ideas and images of God have real consequences for religious quests and spiritual practice. For human beings longing for a deep sense of meaning and purpose within the trials and triumphs of life. What language do we use? What images do we conjure? What source do we seek? Just as the Enlightenment and early modern thought posed serious questions to traditional Western religions, late 20th century critiques offered new challenges to traditional ideas of God. This is just the fact. Feminist insights challenged the masculine gendered references to God. Liberation and womanist theologies proffered arguments against the colonial, patriarchal, and hierarchical constructions of God. Philosophers posed questions about the meaning of words for God that have no actual references in reality. The toll of these mounting critiques have become too much for so many. The old idea of God just feels incoherent and became impossible for many, and here including to me, for me to hang on to. You couldn't trick yourself into believing over and above what you suspected could no longer be held true. Some find other ways. Some adopt a kind of willful ignorance, simply ignoring the problem by ignoring the question. Such a person might continue religious practice as a kind of social engagement, and tacitly ignoring the incoherence of the dogma around God. A friend of mine, who is a pastor, in fact, called this the functional atheism of American Protestantism. What he meant by that is that the pews are filled with functional atheists, meaning they don't care about the question of whether or not God exists at all, but continuing to participate in religious ritual has kind of social benefits and obligations. Another option includes a kind of rebellion against the spirit of the age. You dig into to confirm the old constructions. Fundamentalism began and continues as this kind of rebellion against modernity and the fruits of modern sciences and humanities. At the core, for example, of the old debates between science and religion, or creation, creationism, and evolution, is this very knot of how to conceive of the divine when the old conceptions no longer hold sway. As I said, fundamentalism is a reaction and a rebellion against that very trend. For many others, we simply abandon religion. It's an option more common today than ever before. For the first time that we know of, a plurality of Americans under the age of 35 report no religious beliefs at all. They're often called nuns, not N-U-N-S either, by the way. N-O-N-E-S. That doesn't mean that they're atheists, which simply means no God. Rather, nuns are those for whom the question of God no longer matters or has any relevance at all. And as I said, for the first time in history, the plurality of at least the younger age population holds that position. Is there a third way? Of course, I'm suggesting yes. Karen Armstrong concluded her major work, A History of God, writing, "Human beings cannot endure emptiness and desolation. They will fill the vacuum by creating a new focus of meaning." And perhaps that is where I anticipate a future, at least for religious and spiritual quest. The work of Paul Tillich, I've mentioned him many times in my talks, in the 1960s transformed my own thinking. Tillich argued that God cannot be thought of as a being, but rather, he said, God is the ground of being. God is not a being, but rather God is the ground of being. That's classic Tillich. In his book, The Courage to Be, Tillich concluded, with the notion that God or the reality of God is always above and beyond human constructions. He called it the God above God. That's ultimate reality. Others have suggested that the word God itself should be regarded as a metaphor. It's a kind of linguistic placeholder for the divine and the sacred, which eludes language and construction of any kind. We intuit, but cannot fully express or comprehend this reality because it's ineffable. Therefore, we create metaphors, but you have to remember they're always metaphors. They aren't the reality itself. It's like the finger pointing to the moon in the old Buddhist saying, the finger is not the moon. Our language in religion and our language around God consists of these many metaphors, but should not be confused with the reality itself. The reality itself, others would suggest, is a kind of ineffability, the ineffable. This idea that of the ineffable, that there is something we experience, perhaps something we even know, but that we cannot discursively articulate. That may be this third way. It may be an appeal for those who no longer can force themselves into accepting literal ideas of God. Religious ideas and religious language maybe function more like poetry. Maybe religious ideas function more like music. What is the meaning of middle C? And yet it exists. Or perhaps religious language and religious ideas really function at the level of myth. Myth that does not mean false, but rather deep truths that elude other kinds of descriptions. Religion as poetry means we use words ironically to get at that which cannot be articulated. Religion as music, we use experience to get at the deep feeling that we experience in the world, but cannot find expression through language. Or religion as myth. We use stories all the time to get at non-discursive truths. Could we use the word God to get at that, you know, something that isn't a thing, that lies beyond words yet rests in our hearts as awe and wonder? I remember my old St. Olaf music professor, a man named G. Winston Kassler, a brilliant composer himself, but who would say in lectures, I do not know if I believe in God, but I have experienced Bach. Finally for today, one more thing, and then I'll quit. I want to recall a biblical notion, the radical notion that has been underappreciated, first suggested in the letter of John in the New Testament, that God is love. God is love. John wrote, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God, and God lives in them. Well, we could ask, what is love other than the ineffable? We can describe experiences of love, all kinds of types of love, sexual, friendship love, deep, long committed love, all kinds of things. But the thing itself, love itself, it eludes us. We turn to poetry and music and myth. A reality that can be experienced, the deepest of which we can ever experience, but eludes pinning down. Again, Bishop Spong wrote, ultimately, we discover that our God experience is like swimming in an eternal ocean of love. God is the ultimate source of love. One worships this God by loving, living in love, loving wastefully, spreading love frivolously, giving love away without stopping to count the cost. God simply is love. That's going to be the last word for today. But remember, this is a series, so I'm anticipating the next time that I speak to you when we'll consider what this means as incarnation, incarnate love. For today, that's probably enough. All right, thanks.